Welcome back, WNST, Tassel Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. You know, this is a Baltimore Positive segment when I've got the State Fair shirt on here in El Guapo, and I've carried out some duck carnitas recently. But the big story here this month is local, and Taharka, and the wheels and the bus go round. Don Moeller has decided that he's going to be ordering this for everyone in the family. He's got a lot of Moellers over there in Catonsville. 8 pints to come to you, $15.70 off. Use the Baltimore Positive code. Don, I'm just going to say this to you. Sweet potato crumble. Sweet potato crumble. That's the most important thing when you're ordering. Also, our friends at Fadley's, Coach Billick shipped a dozen crab cakes out to Ohio last week. We had him on with Damie. There were lots of smiles. Good holiday cheer. Shop local. Take care of our sponsors. Moeller & Gary Realty also out there getting the job done. Crown Title. We're going to have a lot of stuff here as we go into 2021. But I'm going to tell you right now, Moeller, you've done it again. You've reached into my Wayback Machine. At some point, you're going to find a preschool teacher or somebody in my life who's in my life as long as you've been in my life. For the new audience here, tuning in to see Rafael Alvarez, my one-time mentor at the Baltimore Sun in 1986, 87, and 88. And I talk about it all the time. But, you know, I've known Don since 82. Rafael, I've known you since 86. It's a pleasure to have you on. And I know, Don, we had the original list of people I wanted on the show. And I said, I want to talk writing and being Hispanic with Rafael. Get him on. Took us 2 years to get you, man. I appreciate you coming on, brother.
Thanks. I got to correct you on that Hispanic thing. I'm a classic product of Highlandtown, in which my name is Rafael Alvarez, and I'm mostly Polish. And I don't speak Spanish.
I don't either. I was a gringo with an Aparicio name. Same as you, man.
My namesake grandfather, whose house I live in now, is from Spain. So I'm a white European with a lot of St. Casimir mixed in with Our Lady of Pompeii.
Well, I can't think of a better guest. And I know, Nestor, I mean, Rafael, we've had Fraser Smith on, Barry Raskovar on. We go down the list, and Nestor is always, you know, very, very I guess almost reverential, I'd say, in the sense of the fact that those of you who were there before him really taking him under his wing and making a difference. And when I look at your career, and we're going to talk about some things that we have in common as well, but you have this, and you touched on it. I had written down in my notes, you talked about your bad Polish, Italian, Spanish. We got it all. Linthicum. But
sounds like a really good stew. You know.
Linthicum, the Mount St. Joe, the Highland Town. I mean, you got it all. You have – what comes through to me, and I want to start with this before we get into your books and your TV shows and your latest projects. When I think of Rafael Alvarez, whether I'm following you on Instagram or Facebook or wherever it is, I'm thinking of this guy that's about as Baltimore can get. I mean, your love of this city just oozes out of every pore. Where does that come from? Where was it nurtured? Where did it come from? And how do you keep that fire lit today?
Thanks for the question. And Nestor, thanks for your kind words.
I'm not done. I got plenty more for you.
Okay. So on my mother's side, we've been here since the mid-19th century or the late 19th century with the waves of Poles that came after the first wave of Germans. Most people forget the largest single immigrant group in Baltimore were not Greeks or Italians. They were the Germans, followed by German Jews. On my father's side, it goes back to, as I said, my grandfather who came here from Spain. I think he jumped ship in Fells Point around 1925, okay? My parents graduated from Patterson Park High School in 1952. They got married the next year at age 19. They grew up in neighborhoods that I romanticize in my fiction. I don't romanticize it so much in my journalism, but in my fiction. And as they tell it, there's not much to romanticize. I mean, small houses, lots of kids, every neighbor knew your business, and they couldn't wait to get out. And we're talking about the early 50s. We're talking about the first post-war wave of getting to the burbs, the promised land, so to speak. But they were indelibly, you know, Dad's from Greektown, used to be called the Hill back in the day. Highland Town gets its name because it's high land. It sits on a hill up by City Hospital. Mom grew up in Old Canton when it was literally a Polish colony. She heard the mass in Polish long before she ever heard it in English.
So I was Our Lady of Fatima, by the way. Everybody was Polish in my parish in the 70s.
Yep.
I ran into Mark Karolkowski at the supermarket the other day. There you go.
So the old cliche, you can take the boy out of Highland Town, but you can't take the Highland Town out of the boy. They move us to the Anne Arundel County burbs, Linthicum, when BWI was Friendship Airport.
Why that way? Did your dad have a job that way? My dad moved east because the job was at Martin's. And, you know, my dad took a job at Westinghouse for 10 minutes, but then stopped and came back to Bethlehem Steel because he didn't want to go through the tunnel. But there really was a flight in all sorts of directions, right? Like Highland Town didn't all go to Dundalk and Essex, and it didn't always work that way, right?
No, it didn't. But my father did go against the grain. Most of Highland Town did go first to Dundalk, then to Rosedale.
See, I know my history, Red. See, I know that. I know Jacques.
I don't think my father wanted to be near his relatives. But anyway, there are parts of Harford County now that are old Highland Town. Same families across the cul-de-sac that lived across, you know, Conklin Street from each other. But anyway.
And in the 80s and 90s, they either lived in Dundalk, Parkville, and they moved that direction, right? It's third generation goes to Harford County, right?
Well, and, you know, the Jewish folks started in Little Italy. Little Italy had the first synagogue, not Lombard Street. And now they're almost in, the Jewish community now is in Owings Mills. But to get back to my family story, this is the moment, and I'll tie it into being a storyteller. So even we grew up in Linthicum. I'm in their basement now. It's a brick rancher. It's their dream. They achieved their dream. They're savers, you know. They would save and buy good furniture to last the rest of their lives. They were not going to go buy new furniture every 5 years. Every weekend, and this is the story, Nestor and Don, this is the crucible of all my storytelling. We'd leave the manicured lawns of Linthicum, where the only smell was cut grass and the only sound was the whir of the air conditioners. That was it. And we'd go back into the city. And even though I'm a lifetime Baltimorean, I never got to Roland Park till I was 30 years old. That wasn't Baltimore. Baltimore was three neighborhoods: Fells Point, which a real Baltimorean calls Broadway. I hate when they call it Fells; it makes me nauseous. Canton, old Polish Canton, and then Highland Town. Every weekend, Sunday dinner at my Italian grandmother's in what is now Greektown. I would often spend the night there. You may know this phrase, Don. In the 50s and 60s, they went nightclubbing. Rat pack kind of, the Baltimore version of whatever the rat pack.
There you go. Right.
And I would spend the night with my grandmother on Saturday night, wake up Sunday.
Were they at like Club Venus? Where were they going? Tell me.
No. They were
way earlier than that.
Yeah, way earlier in Club. Club Venus was more of the mid-60s.
Okay.
They were going to places called the Grunwald Club, which were really sort of like private social clubs,
I know the Grunwald Club. Sispaniak invites me down there every year, man. I get like a special pass to let me in, you know, so.
So I would wake up. I mean, going from Linthicum, I swear, into the city was like Dorothy going from Kansas to Oz. All of a sudden, there were sounds, there were smells. My senses responded as a storyteller before I knew I was a storyteller. And I also have an old soul, and you know, there's just something about the spirits of neighborhoods that went back, you know, Fells Point goes back before the founding of the nation. So, and my old man worked on tugboats, Nestor. That's a real big deal. If I want to play the game of who's got the better Baltimore pedigree, it's hard to trump a guy whose father worked on tugboats, you know?
My dad did soup lines in Scranton, and now Biden's running the country, so I feel a little piece of my dad every time Joe gets up. Well, yeah, Raphael, I want to ask you about Linthicum in the area. Where did you go to high school then? And what
Mount St. Joseph.
Mount St. Joe.
All right.
Nestor, does Don get to talk, Nestor?
No.
Well, you're the guest on the show.
Okay. So anyway, we had a routine every weekend. It would be grandmom's on Macon Street for homemade spaghetti, homemade pasta, everything from scratch. She'd roll out the dough. And then that would be like your classic 2 p.m. supper. Then for dessert, we'd go to my Polish grandmother's for raisin bread and coffee. Then the nightcap would be Broadway, where one of my father's tugboat friends, who was from Spain, who was captured by Franco's forces during the Spanish Civil War. It's one of those stories. He was petrified. Even after Franco was dead, this man would not talk about the Spanish Civil War. And that combination, that was the magical triangle of homemade spaghetti on Macon Street, hearing them talk, and the distinct differences in the families. My father's family was male, Mediterranean, patriarchal. My mother's family was Polish women running the show. It didn't help that my mother's father suffered from a great thirst, if that means anything to you guys. And his thirst was hourly, if not daily. And my grandmother, my Polish grandmother, worked in sweatshops. She sewed sandbags for the Allies during World War II. She was, if you want to Google one of my favorite stories, is she did allow me to do some deep research with her. And she worked in what they called the packing houses, which really the canneries. She was a bean snipper. She worked at... I heard phrases like piecework. You know, I don't think your average kid, they might, if they know anything about piecework, they may think it's like a United Nations heal the world thing. But no, piecework is where you got paid by how many buckets of tomatoes you could skin in 15 minutes. And if my grandmother was the lead tomato skinner, and the other women would get pissed off at her because she worked too fast. You're making us look bad, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the foundation of all my work, whether it's journalism, and I got along at the Sun very well as a young man, as you did too, Nestor, because I knew the city in ways that the Ivy League boys did not. When the brewery workers went on strike, I called my Uncle Ernest. When the auto workers went on strike, I called my Uncle George. When the stevedores went on strike, I called my father's best friend's brother. This is Baltimore, and then...
Hey, by the way, he called me when the Baltimore newspaper guild went on strike because I went out with a sign with you, too, so...
Yes, that's right. That's right. So, this early memory sums up what it means to be a Baltimorean and the son of a man, so to speak. And I'm not talking about macho bullshit. I mean somebody who's respected in his craft. I was a 20-year-old. I started at the Sun in the circulation department. I was 19, dispatching trucks and also writing for the city paper for free. I was one of the first staff members.
Late 70s, where are we here?
77.
Got it.
We're in 77. I'm 19 years old. So I'm going to Loyola College. I'm working at nights in the circulation department, and I'm writing for the city paper. And the longshoremen go on strike. And there was a little, an editorial meeting with these young kids from Hopkins. I was the first non-Hopkins guy at the city paper. It was like a Hopkins mafia sort of thing. And they started talking about this longshoremen strike, you know, because the union had frozen out the Sun for perceived unfairness. And I said, I think I could do that story. And they look at me like, who's this kid? You know, and I said, I don't know. They're all right, fine. Go see if, you know, they're not, the union's not talking to anybody. See what you can do. So I go to my dad and he says, call Mr. Gilbert. Now, Gilbert is the head of the Longshoremen's Union and also the brother of my father's drinking buddy, right? So I go over to Gil. Gilbert, I don't know what he thought I was or where I was from. Nobody knew what the city paper was. He probably thought I was doing a school paper, you know? And halfway through, I say, Mr. Gilbert, you know, you guys aren't talking to Channel 13. You're not talking to the Sun. Why are you talking to me? Here's the lesson I'll never forget. He looks right in my eye like I'm an idiot and says, who's your father? Bang. I wrote the story. I scooped the Sun at age 19, cut my hair, put on a suit, went to the personnel department, and that's how I got in the sports department as a clerk at the age of 20.
How long was your hair? All right, just checking.
Nestor, are you sure? Are you sure that you and Raphael were not like somehow separated at birth? Because this story that he just told.
Well, I can't be Simon and Garfunkel. He's already got a Simon, for crying out loud, you know?
I mean, you showed up and you talked your way in. You know, we say, Raphael, we never go in a straight line. You talk about your dad working at the docks. One of the things that I did not know about you, I knew a lot about you, obviously, always been real proud of you as a St. Joe compatriot. We'll talk about our
No,
our
you're going to sing the song. Go
ahead. I'm not going
to
sing.
When I asked him where he went before to school, I thought you were going to sing. And then I get insulted for not letting you have the mic, and you could have sung.
You want me to sing Purple and Cream?
No,
again.
I don't want you to sing it.
Hail Mount St. Joseph High. Hail Alma Mater.
There you go.
Hail Guardian of our youth. Hail Alma Mater. Thy sons are we ever to be faithful to thy name.
Oh,
hail Mount St. Joseph. Hail.
There you go, Nestor.
Jalen Smith, there you go. I'm going to applaud that, gentlemen. There you go.
You asked for it, Nestor.
I'm surprised it took us 20 minutes in this segment. Raphael Alvarez is our guest. Don Moeller's here. Go ahead, Don. Have at it. Yeah, you were talking about the longshoreman, right?
I did, because as much as I knew about Raphael, I did not know this piece. And I want you to tell me, and sometimes you read things and they're not true. But it says, when Raphael Alvarez left the Sun, and we'll talk about you leaving the Sun, your love of journalism, and try to compare really journalism to your other work in fiction and nonfiction. But when you left the Sun, it says you went to work on a ship. And I had to read that twice. Did you leave the Sun and go to work on a ship? And if you did, talk about that.
Well, let's go back to being 18 years old and graduating from Mount St. Joe. I got a feeling my St. Joe experience was a little different from yours. If you know what I mean.
You were down there behind the tower having a little fun, were you?
This was the 70s.
Yeah, it was the lower road. We were down by the lower road.
What music were you listening to? Can I ask that at that point?
Yeah, 70? Frank Zappa, The Who, and Robin Trower.
Got it. All right, that's all I need to know.
My father is the kindest and most gentlest of men. He's not a waterfront tough guy, right? He's not Lee J. Cobb in On the Waterfront. He was stern and when it came to things like education and respecting the family and stuff like that, but not a hard ass at all. And being a product of the 70s, I had more than my share of fun. Let's put it that way, okay? And we started knocking heads a little bit. I never wanted to be a reporter, ever. I wanted to be a writer with a capital W. And I don't want to embarrass myself, but you know, the great shelf of literature is what I've been aiming for.
You wanted to be Hemingway and I wanted to be Oscar Madison. Two different things, right? Literally, right?
Okay, I don't want to be Hemingway anymore, I can tell you that. I'm already a year older than him. The stories that got told around the spaghetti dinner table when I was a kid, when we would go into the city, were all about ships. My grandfather came here on a ship from Spain. My father left Highlandtown at age 17 the first time and got on a Bethlehem steel ore boat that went down to Venezuela. And there was always some strange dude with a funny accent at our dinner table who was off a ship, you know, because that's the community is you take, you know, it's a fraternity, so to speak. And when I first started getting my big literary dreams, I started bugging my father to go to sea. I want to get on a ship, Dad. I want to get on a ship. He kept saying, oh, no, my influence, I don't have influence down there anymore, which I didn't believe. But the more I started getting into a little bit of trouble, the more he decided he did have some influence down there. So I went to sea right out of Mount St. Joe at 18. It was a container ship. I wasn't, but there's so much you wish you knew, not about how to act, but just knowledge. This was the Mayaguez from the Khmer Rouge situation with, was it Lloyd Butcher was the captain of that?
Lloyd Bucher, yes.
Yeah. It was a World War II hospital ship converted into some sort of troop transport. The Khmer Rouge took it. And then by the time I was on it, it was a rust bucket owned by Navieras de Puerto Rico. And I was an 18-year-old, completely ignorant kid who wanted to be. Nestor will tell you this. In our day, you didn't need 2 master's degrees and 5 internships to have a shot as a job as a clerk in a newspaper. I always thought, and I counsel young people today, you know, the MFA is not exactly the way you want to go if you want to be a real writer. If you want to be a teacher, fine. But, and their parents really are not pleased with this sort of thing. But I always say, run away with the circus, man. You know, so to me, it was.
You got a Hunter S. Thompson sort of view on that, right? In order, there's a freedom that needs to be there in order to write. And you have to have some freedom to piss some people off because you're not going to make people happy, no matter what you write, right?
You also need to know the world that you can't find in academia. And I just realized I might have insulted Don by saying, if you feel like you want to be a teacher.
No, not at all. Because you're telling a life story here, and I'm actually hanging on every word, so keep going.
I'm going to tell you a little story connected with going to sea at 18. And it's not just, you know, to respond to Nestor real quickly about Hunter S. Thompson, he was a very serious young man with great ambition before he became a caricature of himself. He suffered from the Elvis syndrome, in which after he went gonzo, he was almost imprisoned by that personality. Hunter S. Thompson retyped The Great Gatsby word for word as a teenager to feel what it was like to have those words go across a piece of paper. Those are my heroes. So my idea was, this was sort of my best thinking to become a writer. I got on this ship with a bunch of blank notebooks, and I bought myself a copy of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens to sort of teach myself what structure was like. I read David Copperfield, and I tried to the best of my ability to learn to be an ordinary seaman, and it went pretty well. I even did things like, I don't think I'm quite the extrovert that Nestor is, but I'm not shy either. I wrote to the Playboy Advisor, because that was all the magazines that were on the ship, you know, were those kind of magazines. And asked how, you know, I'm 18 years old. I'm asking, how do you get an agent? You know, when kids ask me that now, I say, well, maybe let's try to learn to write an English sentence first. And the Playboy Advisor wrote me back and said, you want to get this book called Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith. So when the ship hit New Orleans, I went to the public library. I found Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith. I borrowed it. This is 40 years ago, and it's still on my shelf today.
Hell of a fine you got there, bro. You bankrupted New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. And I just started, it would almost be like a self-taught guitarist just practicing chords. All I did was practice chords. I went back to Loyola. No, then I started my freshman year at Loyola. And
why'd you get off the ship?
Because I was living in these two different worlds. I mean, it was a summertime job. I made enough in the summer to pay for my first year at Loyola.
Fair enough.
You know?
It wasn't a lifestyle. It was a journey. It was a little quick trip.
Pretty much. But, you know, these two kids from Highlandtown and Canton and graduated from Patterson in 1952, part of that suburban dream was they would have children that went to college. And I'm the firstborn. And also, look, buddy, you know, I'll be the first to admit school was always much easier for me than work. I mean, that was work. These men worked. It was labor.
Right.
You know?
I worked construction a number of summers, and I come home and say to my mother, okay, I'm able to sort of begin to categorize what I want to do and what I don't. I mean, these guys
might be time to go to Westminster, right, Don?
These guys, 50, 60, 70 years old, throwing hundreds of pounds of stuff on their back, lugging concrete. I'm going, that's real work, as Raphael said.
That's real work. I wanted the experience. The romance of the sea and its relationship to literature is inextricable. So then I went back the second summer. And by this time, I was in love with a girl from Dundalk, who's the
mother
of my
children.
There.
We've all been there, you know.
She is another one of Baltimore's great writers. You should have her on the show, Deborah Rudisill. She wrote a history of Bethlehem Steel called Roots of Steel. And now, you know, we're 19 years old and it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I go back to sea for that second summer. Again, I'm paying my way through Loyola College, which at the time, this will blow your mind, was like $8,000 a year. And when I come back from the second summer and I go back to Loyola, I see this bundle of newspapers in the Loyola College cafeteria. And it's not the Greyhound, the school newspaper. It's this thing called the City Paper. And I'm reading it. And, you know, it was still close enough to the hippie years where it was sort of underground. Or
ads for the Marble Bar and sort of like that.
Yeah, ads for the Marble Bar, of course. And being a nester kind of a guy, I call him up and I tell him I'm a writer because there was a phone number in the front. Now, that
same thing I did.
I'm telling you, I think you guys were separated.
Same thing I did. Yeah.
I really do.
Telling him I was a writer was not a lie and it was not the truth. You know, I mean, I'd never been published, but I wrote every day and that began my journey. So then, Don, to get back to your original question, so I sailed for two summers as a teenager. Right after the City Paper, I worked my way up to the city desk at the Sun. And after 25 years of answering phones and listening to people bitch and moan and having politicians lie to you and covering, you know, hundreds of dead teenagers, I started daydreaming about a job where I could just wash dishes. Now, by this time, I've got three kids, two in college, one in private high school. And I cannot deny them their middle class birthright because dad wants to go play Herman Melville again, right? So I go back to the union. By this time, you know, I'm established enough where, you know, my dad's influence isn't necessary. And I talk to their communications director and he figures out a way for me to do it because through the union, I was able to get, I had basically close to minimum wage salary, but Cadillac benefits. I mean, real Cadillac, old school, Blue Cross, Blue Shield union benefits. So I was able to take, you can chase money, as you both know, you can't chase health benefits. It's a squeeze. It's how they get you. So I was able to provide health care for my kids while doing my thing at sea. I sailed for another 2 years, and then Simon called and invited me to write for The Wire, in part because I was working on a ship.
I want to ask you about this because, like, I and this is the part where I will be reverential to you and all those things that Don talks about. And I walked into the Sun newsroom in January of 1986. You know, I had been seeing your byline forever, and yours was a unique Hispanic name. Not that I associated with that, but it was different from the Smiths and the Joneses and the other names that were in the paper, right? And I came in, and because of the weirdness of me being, to your point, a clerk, I worked a midnight shift for the Evening Sun. I came in on Sunday night. I went home on Friday morning. So I worked Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday. But I was there all night long. I reported to work at 11 o'clock or whenever the Hammerjack show ended. I did not have the same green desires that you had, but I like some beer. I'm from Dundalk, you know, so seeing you and Simon and Dick Irwin and people that were covering dead bodies, one of which was my childhood friend, and I know you remember Vincent Adolfo.
Good Lord.
Yes. So Vinny was a childhood friend of mine, neighbor three doors down. You know, a police murder had come to the doorstep of my house when I was 15, 16 years old, and I was working at the News American at the time. But to see you guys come in every night, and you were always like sort of frazzled, you know what I mean? Like it hasn't all the president's men kind of feeling for the 17. I was 17 years old, Raph. My parents had to sign a permission slip to get me into the guild so I could walk the picket line with you a year and a half, 2 years, whatever, 87, 88, whatever that was. But watching you guys every night come in, and there was always such energy about you and Simon. I'm going to throw myself on the full mercy. I've never watched an episode of The Wire. I only know of the reputation of it. So I have nothing. I'm not going to sit here and break down. I don't have any of that. But you make it like Simon called me and we're going to write The Wire. I mean, that's changed your life, right? The last 20 years of doing
sure,
that, right?
Sure, sure. It wasn't like he called me and said, we're going to write The Wire. Him and Ed Burns had already sold it. And he threw me a script in season one. This is a funny story. So I'm now working on ships and writing for HBO simultaneously. So on a ship, you can't throw garbage overboard. So they have an incinerator in the, you know, below decks. I almost said in the basement. If I said a ship had a basement, my father would kill me. You throw these huge bags of garbage in the incinerator, and then after they're turned to ash, you throw another one in. And the fun is when your buddy's not looking, you throw in an aerosol can so it explodes and he jumps. But when my first episode of The Wire aired, I'm on a ship in the incinerator room, filthy dirty with this other guy, and we're throwing bags of garbage into the incinerator, and I say, I needed to tell somebody. I said, hey, an episode I wrote is going to be on HBO tonight. He goes, yeah, right, asshole. Throw me that bag of garbage.
Right. He's going, yeah, have another drink.
I ask you just from a writing technique standpoint here, you know, like you're going to write
an
episode.
Wait, Nestor, let me finish the story about how I got on The Wire so people don't think that me and David Simon created The Wire. It was already created. He sold it to HBO. I got one script in the first season because I had also written a script for Homicide: Life on the Street. Simon actually made that invitation to a lot of his son friends. And I was like one of the few guys that took him up on it. I actually learned how to do it. But he always, those five seasons of The Wire would have been five nonfiction books Simon would have written had he not become successful in television. And those five seasons are The Failed War on Drugs, The Death of Organized Labor, The Hollowness of Reform, The Failure of the Public School System, and then The Complicity of the Media in all of the above. I was hired to be a staff member of season two because of my union childhood waterfront background and working on ships.
Some of the stuff you wrote, if I remember, Raphael, your episodes dealt with the whole dock episodes, right? Losing container, and Nestor hadn't seen it, but losing containers and trying to figure out what's going on down at the docks. That's where you zeroed in, right?
Yes, but and not just for knowledge of how that part of capitalism works, but for the verisimilitude of the actual guys on the docks. All I did was sort of recreate my father's drinking buddies. You know how it was, Nestor, back in the old neighborhoods. You could go to a bar with your old man when you were seven. They'd sit you at a little table with a Coca-Cola and a bag of Wise potato chips. And your old man would have a few with his buddies, and then you'd leave. So anyway.
Rossville Inn, there was a pool table. Yeah, I had two alcoholic parents. So yes, I mean, very much so. I knew every bar in East Baltimore.
Yep. And then so season three, I did another script and also was asked to write the sort of the encyclopedia that goes with the show, sort of a Bible sort of thing of The Wire. And then after season
three. Is that the truth be told, Raphael?
Yes.
That's the truth be told. Yeah.
After season three, there was an 18-month hiatus while Simon successfully argued with HBO for seasons four and five. And during that 18-month hiatus, I went to L.A. and because I had three kids in college at the same time. And, you know, I just put myself out there as a writer for hire and made enough money to get all three kids through college with the great help of their mother, Deborah Rudisill. And then after I worked on four or five shows, the Writers Guild of America went on strike at Halloween of 07. I was a strike captain. And when the strike ended, I was fired. And I said, you know, if I'm going to be unemployed, I'm going to be unemployed in Baltimore. And after The Wire, Hollywood cop shows are not that much fun, to tell you the truth, but they're lucrative.
Well, let me, I want to jump to, I really do. I knew we're going to have Raffy. We're going to have you back on. I knew we would scratch the surface today because this is about as Baltimore as a Baltimore positive episode can be. I don't want to belabor The Wire either. I do have one quick question about it. And then I want to jump to your Thanksgiving essay in the Pittsburgh paper, because I thought it was just amazing and touched so many of us, recognized your experience in that, and I want to talk about your mom and dad. But one of my takeaways from The Wire, and for those out there who have listened to it, you know, it's been a point of a lot of discussion. I've always found, and Nestor didn't read it, but there's a principal police figure, Nestor, named McNulty. And I've always said to people, Raphael, that I found him to be one of the most complex personalities in fiction that I've ever encountered. Did you, when you were writing The Wire, did you view him as this really complex individual, or had you known McNulty's?
You have to remember that The Wire was co-created and co-executive produced by a former Baltimore City homicide detective named Ed Burns. And it's no coincidence that Ed Burns went on to become a Baltimore City public school teacher, and season four is about the public school. So even though individual scripts have specific writers' names on them, we cross-pollinated in that, you know, whatever your strength was, you focused on that, and that if you needed help in certain areas, you would go to one of the other four or five writers. McNulty was very much the bastion of Burns and Simon. I was able to put some words into McNulty's mouth, but I can't say that I contributed to his psyche. A funny story, Nestor will love this. So I was really called on a lot of times for average Baltimorean verisimilitude, very closely reflective of the kind of Baltimoreans I wrote about at The Sun. After I learned the ropes, I started to consider myself something of a Baltimore folklorist. So early in season two, there's a beef. That's a real Baltimore word, a beef.
Yeah, there you go. Know?
And
that's an Irvington word there, Raphael. That's an Irvington word.
But not Yale Heights.
No.
But anyway, so there's a pissing match over who's going to donate a beautiful stained glass window between a Highland Town cop captain, Southeast District, and the head of the Longshoremen's Union. And both of them want the accolade of paying for the window. So they needed a parish priest, right? And they hire this actor, and they tell the actor, who's not from Baltimore, you're a Polish priest. And he comes in with this like heavy Warsaw accent. And they're like, no. They say, Alvarez, take him out and teach him, right?
Oh, boy.
What's so much fun about writing for The Wire. In my own backyard, the people I've known my whole life, getting to create them for, you know, the entire nation. So I tell the guy, come on, buddy. We go to the Double T on Pulaski Highway, Nestor.
Perfect. Was Elvis out there yet? It was before Elvis appeared. Yes.
That's right. And I find a booth. I'm looking. He goes, what are you looking for? I said, just calm down. I'm checking out. I find this table where there's a woman. I swear to God, she's the spitting image of divine, right? Except she's a real woman. And I it's not good to make fun of people's body appearance, but she's so big. She's sitting in the booth with her legs apart so she can get close to the actual table. And there's some woman across from her, and they're talking, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, there's an empty booth next to them. I said, that's where we're going. He goes, you brought me here to sit next to them to learn how to be a Polish priest? I said, yeah. So his back is to them, so they can't see him. And I say, just listen. Just listen.
Wow.
And on the drive back to the soundstage, we practiced him talking the way he had heard these two people talk, and he still blew it.
Raphael, I had the privilege of running into Danny DeVito when he was here acting, and I had a conversation with him, and I'll never forget him talking about learning how to say the word egg in Baltimore.
Hey, Christ, you want an egg?
Eggs. My wife makes an egg every day, and I do the Danny DeVito egg from Tin Men. You know what I mean? Because
yes.
There is, yep, a part of making it authentic. This is what I wanted to ask you, though, on writing, where you, when you talk about five writers and developing these characters, and Don, I appreciate that question because it went right into where I wanted to go, which is, I thought, I guess just from the outset, these are Simon's thoughts about these characters, but you're telling me there's a whole team of people that make a mayor, and a cop, in the way the show was structured, that it wasn't just, that I would think that's the hardest thing in the world. Here, write an episode. For who? For what? I don't even know who these characters are. That you have to sort of learn who the characters are in order to write that, right?
Of course. Of course. It's like building anything. It's building, so again, you know, Simon and Burns created the world, and these scripts go through various edits and various drafts, and then before it goes to HBO, Simon takes the last pass at it. So he'll buff it up here or there or whatever, or you know, here's the conversation in the room with, you know, what's called the writer's room, and you want a diverse writer's room. That's been a big challenge in Hollywood. The biggest question, or sometimes the biggest debate, would occur when someone would say, to Don's point, McNulty would never say that.
Right.
You're talking about one line, right? You're not talking about where he grew up or if he cheated on his wife or you're like, no, McNulty would never say that. It doesn't ring true. And then the other guy would say, well, why not? And then you would have to argue almost in a psychoanalytical way the precedent of his behavior to allow him to say something like that. Now, that's for an important line. For a throwaway line, when I say throwaway lines, I mean lines that are sort of like candy. They're used just, you know, to make people smile. You go back maybe to some of your own personal experiences. In season two, McNulty is busted from investigations to riding the police boat. That's how they punished him. And when I was an 18-year-old on a ship, and I still to this day, if you're a seaman and you can't tie knots, you got no business being on a ship. And for the life of me, I had trouble learning to tie knots till this one old timer says, "Oh, you're tying a Baltimore knot." And I said, "What's a Baltimore knot?" He goes, "A knot that's never tied the same way twice." So I was able to throw that in, and that played, you know, because it really didn't speak to anything about the man's psyche or character. You know, and every once in a while, you know, I would be given a character to create from scratch. And that's where, like, you bring in your own stuff. My single favorite and moment I'm most proud of in The Wire, and Nestor, I know you will love this, and it might send you into orbit. Don, do you know where I'm going?
No, but I can't wait.
I didn't see The Wire. I'm going to watch The Wire when I leave Baltimore. If I ever don't live here, is when I'm going to watch it. That All was right. sort well, of my role.
You will appreciate this. You'll appreciate this whether you watch The Wire or not. So, do you know what an Easter egg is in film, Nestor?
No.
An Easter egg is where you hide something.
It's a hidden thing. Okay, fair enough.
It has absolutely nothing to do with the story, but it pleases the writer. And you hope somebody out there in TV land will see it.
Okay.
So this was my all-time favorite Easter egg. The head of the union and a lobbyist, closely modeled on Don's old friend Bruce Bariano. Didn't you and Bruce, like, develop some waterfront property?
Respectfully, Ralph, respectfully. I'm going to tell you, Alvarez, you get great stuff on The Wire. Respectfully, that's what I'm just telling you.
So,
that is Bruce.
Yeah, the union dude's getting an education on how shit really works. Like, if you think this petty bullshit on the docks stealing a car once in a while is the game, you got no idea. The game takes place in Annapolis. And the lobbyist really pisses the union guy off, and off he, you know, the union guy throws the lobbyist out of his office. He's so pissed off. And the longshoreman's office, Nestor, is a trailer on the docks, you know, just a little, you know, two wooden steps. And he takes a dart. And he turns around, he's so mad, and he throws it with all his might at the dartboard behind his desk. It lands in a bullseye. Who's in the bullseye, Nestor?
No idea.
Robert Irsay.
Oh, right. You know what?
Oh, Nestor, that's for you.
I have been told that about The Wire. Absolutely. So
that
there.
Was, you know, so you don't win an Emmy for putting Robert Irsay on a dartboard. But I swear to you, for all the Baltimoreans who have left Baltimore and are out there and watch that, and we don't, it's not identified. It doesn't say Robert Irsay under his face, but it's that one in the overcoat from the airport, you know?
I'm in Azarona. Call a tower.
Well, you know, I got a couple things before we get out of here. But I got to tell you, know what you just said, Raphael? So important. You said, doesn't say Robert Irsay underneath that. And that reminds me, I said, man, we got another whole hour we could do. Reminds me of the final game at Memorial Stadium when, to the Field of Dreams music, all the Orioles came out one by one. And someone said to me, I mean, I'm up there crying like everybody else said, I wish they would announce who they were. And I can remember saying, if you have to be told who they are, You don't belong here.
That's
today.
Right. I was in the press box that day, and I cried like a baby.
Oh, I mean, I was like,
I was in 34 lower, and I, you know, my father was dying at that point, like at the end of his life, and couldn't be there. It was terrible. That was one of the saddest days I've experienced in my adulthood.
I told Michael Olesker to this day, it's my favorite line that he ever wrote. The day after that game, Michael Olesker wrote, for years, moms and dads took their kids to 33rd Street. Yesterday, the kids returned the favor. That said, because I had my mom. I mean, she had lugged. I mean, it just, I can almost cry thinking about it now. Listen, before we let you get out of here.
Wait. I got to tell you another great Baltimore story about my mother is the queen of malaprops, right? So
that's Gloria Alvarez.
Yes, Gloria Alvarez. Do you guys both have an Alexa in your house?
Of course.
No.
I do. I don't know.
Do you know what an Alexa is?
Yes, Nestor? You talk to it. Yes.
Yeah, my parents have one. I don't have one. So to get it to turn on, you have to say, Alexa. And then it comes on. My mother to this day says, Alesker. I'm like, Mom. Mom. It's not Alesker. It's Aleska. So she goes, okay, I'll do it right this time. Alesker.
Raphael, we'll have you back on soon to talk a little bit about your folks and that journey, because we didn't even get to that, but we're like,
Nestor, wait, but I know we're running late, but we've got to have him take a minute or two and talk about the Thanksgiving essay. We just have to, because it's timely. He wrote about cooking dinner for his mom and dad. Any of us who've had elderly parents, Nestor's had them. I mean, the title of the daggone essay says it all. It's not about the meal. It's about the love. I know you got to run. We've got to run. Give us 2 or 3 minutes on. And why the hell is it in the Pittsburgh paper instead of the op-ed in the Baltimore?
You want to know? You want to know? Because the Tribune doesn't pay shit for freelance. That's why. And the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette throws me a few nickels. I'm not writing for free.
I don't blame you.
Not writing for free. I wrote for free when I was 19 years old and I needed some bylines to get in the game. Fuck Tribune.
Fair enough.
There you go. Good enough. Now, tell us just quickly, because we're all up against the clock, but talk about that essay and the meals for generations and how your family has changed locations. And it's just an amazing story.
Well, for starters, to plug my work a little bit, go to MaconStreetBooks.com, MaconStreetBooks.com, Macon Street Books. I don't know if there's a website for this, Nestor, but if you could put that on there, I'd appreciate it. Thanksgiving is my all-time favorite holiday.
I'll pull it up right now so everybody can see it. How about that? You can talk. Okay. How about that?
There you go.
There you go.
And the Patreon stuff up top is for like $3 a month. You can get everything I write.
Beautiful.
My favorite holiday as well, Raphael. That's probably why I cried when I read your essay. Take it away.
And the reason it's my favorite holiday, Don, is there are no gifts. Madison Avenue still hasn't figured out a way to ruin it or poison it with, you know. There are no gifts, and it's not tied to any specific religion, yet to me it feels like a more religious holiday than Christmas because of the nature of giving thanks. I like that it ushers in a season that physically I love the autumn probably more than spring, you know, that feeling of the sun is still shining, but there's a chill in the air. It's funny. You could have the same exact weather in November as February, but in November it feels great, in February it feels awful. I don't know why that is. But if you read this story, which if you go to the website and send me a note, I'll be sure to send anyone who wants it, you'll learn that the kitchen table was the true altar of my family. And I talk about the different ethnic, the weave of my background, and certain meals from Old Canton, certain meals.
You get sauerkraut kielbasa on there?
Not only does it have kielbasa, Nestor, but I talk about my Polish grandmother pushing it through a steer's horn into casing. Now,
Nestor, you got to go.
I just go over to Ostrowski's in the old neighborhood and buy a little bit. That's what I do.
Well, you haven't gone lately because Ostrowski's of Washington Avenue is closed. Ostrowski's of Bank Street is still around. But anyway, there's something. I love that Thanksgiving is always on a Thursday. Christmas is a different day every year, right? There's something about that Thursday followed by 3 days of being off from work that is magical. I'm 62 years old. I still make sure I see a little bit of the Macy's parade, but I'm disappointed that I never see Underdog anymore. It was always my favorite. I write a lot better than I speak, Don. So you know.
Well, I think you do both well. And that, and again, that article, anybody can Google it or send Raphael a note or go to MakingStreetBooks.com. But it's not about the meal. It's about the love. Talks about aging mom and dad and how food was the center and how it's harder and harder for them to enjoy the meal. And what else struck me, Raphael, is how you and your brothers, I mean, it's so Baltimore. I say this might be the most Baltimore positive of all Baltimore positive episodes we've done. How you and your brothers, you're at your mom and dad's house now. You're still a family now, looking out for each other. Those truly American values.
Yeah. And it's interesting the way that dynamic plays out, Don. So on the one hand, I'm here for mom and dad. But on the other hand, I'm here so my brothers don't have to do it by themselves. So I'm here as much for my siblings as I am for mom and dad. But I'll leave you with this. Nestor, you'll love this, being a Dundalk boy. The image of a middle-aged man living in his parents' basement is not a good one. Right? So it particularly in a Baltimore where we know a lot of guys who have, you know, derailed, so to speak, and jumped the tracks. You say, oh, you know, Ralphie's 60 years old and lives in his parents' basement. You think of a guy who's stoned, watching, you know, The Simpsons and playing video games while mooching off of his mom and dad.
I hope you're doing all of that, by the way.
But so I am that 60-year-old dude living in his parents' basement, but it's the flip side of that coin. I'm actually, I lay in bed because, you know, they're right above me, and I don't go to sleep right away because I'm hoping nobody falls out of bed.
Wow. Amazing stuff. Will you come back? Hey, Raphael, will you come back? We didn't even touch the surface. When people hear you're working on a documentary about, wait for it, the Rosary, that's going to pique their interest. Will you come back and talk to us about that documentary? We can talk a little bit more about Mount St. Joe and other Baltimore goodies.
I'll come back if Nestor buys me a crab cake at Fadley's.
We're ready to do it.
That's easy to do. And you get to come back if we get to talk a little bit about Frank Zappa and John Waters as well next time around, all right?
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so
Raphael
much.
Raphael Alvarez.
Go Gales.
Go Gales. Just please, no more singing. No more singing. Go to the website, MakingStreetBooks.com is the way to find Raphael Alvarez. We have extended our time. I want to tell everybody about Taharka Brothers. Make sure, talk about Baltimore positive. Let's keep it local. It says here right on the box, made in Baltimore. This is my favorite part, though, where it says lift up Baltimore on the side. $15.70 off the box. $56 delivered for just $40.30. Use the Baltimore Positive code. Shipping crab cakes and Fadley's throughout the holiday season and taking care of all of our sponsors, including our friends at State Fair, where they also have some good crab cakes and chicken and waffles and shrimp and grits, and across the street at El Guapo. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.